This is the Apostle Paul, verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. When they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet, and he said, I am a Jew born in Tarsus, Cilicia, but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons. As also the high priest and all the council of the elders can testify from them, I also received letters to the brethren and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who were there to Jerusalem as prisoners to be punished. But it happened that as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, Who are you, Lord? He said to me, I am Jesus, the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, Get up, go on into Damascus, and there you will be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. A certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law and well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing near said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very time I looked up at him. And he said, The God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will and to see the righteous one and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. Now why do you delay? Get up and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling upon his name. Okay, well, the title tonight, if you have an outline there, you see the power of asking questions. And this is actually part three of the realization of wrongness that I started about a month ago. So I'm kind of doing two things tonight. I'm wrapping up the realization of wrongness that we had started, and then I'm also kind of breaking off of that, and I'm going to talk about questions, asking questions, like in conversing with people. They call it the Socratic method. If it's like teaching or debate, things of that nature, Socrates was famous for asking questions in terms of his students. When he was talking to people, when he was trying to convince them of his way of doing things, he would ask questions. And, you know, asking questions is a really good way to not only learn, but to teach. We do that a lot, even in church. You know, sometimes I'll throw out a question. And it's a question that I came up with as I was studying. And I mean, sometimes I come up with questions, you know, on the fly. But a lot of times, asking questions is a good way to study. And when I was very first started preaching, that's something I used to do. If I had a text that I was going to preach, you know, if I'm preaching through a book and, okay, this is my next text, I would sit down and I would try to come up with 10 questions based on that text. And what I would do is I'd say, okay, and I would use all kinds of ideas on that. I'd say, what are some questions that the congregation might have based on this text? If they weren't familiar with it, what are some questions they might have? And then I would ask, well maybe an unbeliever. If an unbeliever's there, what kind of questions might they have? Like maybe there's something there that all the Christians are going to know what that means, but an unbeliever wouldn't know. Okay, so that. Or maybe some questions that I have. I'm studying this, and I'm like, well, why did he do it this way? Or why did this... And so I don't do it anymore necessarily. I don't come up with 10 questions because I don't need to anymore. You know, when you're first starting out, you need all the help you can get. It's like, you know, back in the old days, if I had to preach for 30 minutes, like, oh, man, how am I going to preach that long for 30 minutes? First time I ever preached, I think it was 20. And the guy, it was a Sunday night at a little bitty church in Indiana. I was up there on summer missions. Small church, and the missionary I was working for, he said, good job, Shane, you did 20 minutes. That's 1 minute for every person in attendance tonight. So, but, you know, as you do it more, you get to where you, can talk more. And so anyway, asking questions is an important thing. So I'm going to talk about that tonight. You might call it the Socratic method of evangelism or something. Just questions that get asked, not because people are, not because you're ignorant and you need the information, but because maybe you're trying to help somebody else. And asking them questions helps them think things through. So we'll talk about that as it pertains to the Apostle Paul a little bit later. And we'll talk about Peter as we wrap up the part on the realization of wrongness. Now, just an overview, because last Wednesday I wasn't here, and then the Wednesday before that we did part two, and the Wednesday before that we did part one. So it's been really spread out. I mean, what's he talking about, this realization of wrongness? Well, the last two times I've spoken on Wednesday night, that's what we've talked about. And it all kind of came out of the Mark study on Sunday morning, because Mark was wrong about some things. And we talked about, you know, his life and his missionary journey, and then he had deserted, and, you know, Paul and Barnabas disagreed and all that. And so we had talked about, basically I divided it into three categories of realizing you're wrong about stuff: pre-conversion, then at conversion, and then post-conversion. We haven't talked about post-conversion so much yet, but we talked about pre-conversion, and I'd mentioned two things, conviction and conscience, and those aren't the same thing, but they both tell you when you're wrong. When you think of conscience, everybody has a conscience. Even unbelievers have a conscience. When you hear of an unbeliever who feels really bad for some crime they committed and they go and turn themselves in, you know, oh, the Holy Spirit convicted them. Or their conscience just got the better of them. I mean, unbelievers have a conscience. But when you're talking about conviction, that is a Holy Spirit term. And so we talked about that, and that's one of the big differences between a believer and an unbeliever, is an unbeliever might feel bad based on their conscience. A believer feels bad, could be their conscience, working in accordance with the Holy Spirit who indwells them. I mean, it's a whole different situation once you're a believer and you have the Holy Spirit. And so we talked about that last time. Or two times ago, and then we talked about realization of wrongness at conversion. And if you remember, I talked about Simon Peter in this regard. You remember when Jesus gets on the boat and he's teaching from the boat, and then he tells Simon Peter, okay, put out for a catch. And this was when Simon Peter said, we've already fished all night, we didn't catch anything. He kind of, I think bristles a little bit at Jesus for the suggestion that, go one more time. Well, Peter's the fisherman. Jesus is not a fisherman. I mean, you're already tired. You're frustrated. You haven't caught anything. And Peter tells him that. But then he says, but at your bidding, Lord. Okay. So he's patronizing Jesus, isn't he? He's whatever you say, Lord. Kind of like we do with our children or with our senile grandparents or something. Okay, Grandpa, if that's what you want. And so Simon Peter does that to Jesus, and what happens is, boom, more fish than he can handle, more fish than his boat can handle, than his nets can handle. He has to call his partners over. I mean, this is not simply Jesus proving that he's a better fisherman than Peter is. This is Jesus proving he's the Son of God. This is like miraculous. And you remember the reaction of Peter. It was not to come back and say, oh, Jesus, I am sorry that I doubted you. I should not have done that. And he comes back and he says, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. So Peter sees something in that is beyond just a fishing thing. He realized he was wrong. And, I mean, whether or not you would point to that as his conversion, I don't know about that. But definitely, he's starting to figure out who Jesus is in a much deeper way. And over the course of Jesus' earthly ministry, Peter figures it out more and more and more. And, he gets to the point where Peter, he's just completely accurate. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, blessed are you. My Father revealed that to you. In other words, yes, you are right on the dot. You're right. We also talked last time about Nicodemus and the account with him in John 3, one of the most famous conversations in the entire Bible. Nicodemus comes at night. And it's the same kind of deal, all right? Peter, when Peter's talking with Jesus, he knows Jesus is special. He just doesn't realize how special, okay? And I think that's the same way it was with Nicodemus. He knew Jesus was of God. He just didn't realize he was the Son of God. Because he says when he comes, we know that you've been sent of God because no one can do the things you do unless God is with you. Now, that's high praise, but that's not the same as falling at his feet and saying, we know who you are. You're the Son of God. You're the Messiah. You're the Christ. And so Jesus immediately confronts Nicodemus, and it doesn't take long for Jesus to point out that, Nicodemus, you are wrong about some things. You don't know some things. You cannot see the kingdom unless you're born again. What does that mean to Nicodemus? He doesn't understand that in the least. And instead of, you know, what's interesting is when, you know, when you're talking to people who don't understand, if you know the people, like say you're a teacher and you got a classroom full, Aaron can relate to this, you don't necessarily teach every kid the same, right? I mean, they're different personalities. They respond to different things. I mean, some kids, you get onto them hard and they just wilt. Most of them do now because they're all a bunch of babies. But some of them, they have to have a firm hand because if you just try to be sweetsy with them, they'll run you over. That's how I was when I was in school. I preferred the mean teachers. I got along better with the mean teachers, not necessarily mean, but I needed them to be more firm with me. Because if they were kind of weak, I bullied them, you know. That doesn't say much for me, but. Okay, so what does Jesus do with Nicodemus? It's interesting to me to see how Jesus deals differently with different people. He doesn't water down truth with anyone. I mean, he's absolutely honest, obviously, as the Son of God, with everyone. But he treats people differently, kind of, depending on the situation. He knows their heart in ways that we don't. With Nicodemus, he's kind of confrontational, almost insulting when he says, you're the teacher of Israel and you don't know these things. Now, if I tell you earthly things and you don't understand them, how am I supposed to tell you heavenly things? Now, why would Jesus talk to Nicodemus like that? You say, well, Nicodemus seems like a nice guy. I mean, you know, he's coming to Jesus at night. What does that tell you? He's probably ashamed to be seen with Jesus. He's probably a little bit of a chicken. But he would claim to be the teacher of Israel. I mean, he would be one of the top-notch religious leaders within all of Judaism. And so guess what? I think Jesus, obviously, is fully justified in saying, you think you're a teacher in Israel and you don't even know these things? I'm talking about basic heaven and earth-type things, and it's totally beyond you. I talk about, Jesus is talking about regeneration, right? You must be born again. Nicodemus is the greatest teacher in all of Judaism, or at least one of them. He doesn't have the foggiest idea what Jesus is talking about. So I think he needed confronted the way Jesus confronted him. Now, what I mean by how Jesus would talk to people in different ways, the way he would talk to other people, sometimes he would be very tender. I mean, someone that you would expect him to just really, you know, the woman caught in adultery, right? Oh, I mean, that's a bad sin. And she got caught in the very act. And Jesus knew she was being set up. I mean, he wasn't stupid. But at the same time, he was truthful with her, wasn't he? Go your way and sin no more. But he was very gracious with her, too. Where are they? Where are your condemners? Who are they that condemn you? Well, there's none. Well, neither do I condemn you. Go your way and sin no more. I mean, okay, if you want to push Mosaic law into that, okay, stone her. And that's, in fact, what Jesus said. Go ahead, stone her. What? Yeah, whichever one of you is without sin, you can start the flinging. Grab you a rock and go right after her head. You who has no sin. Jesus trapped them, didn't he? It was beautiful. So he dealt with people in different ways. He deals with Nicodemus in this way, and you know, eventually the scales come off Nicodemus' eyes. You can see it as you, it's beautiful as you look through John, because as I've said many times before, he's mentioned three times in John, very prominently. John 3, he's totally lost. He doesn't understand. He's just been introduced really to the gospel, and it boggles his mind. John 7 is where the Sanhedrin, they're making plans to kill Jesus. I mean, they want to catch him. And that's where Nicodemus kind of stands up for Jesus ever so slightly and just says, "Oh, wait a second, we can't do this. I mean, our law requires that a man be tried, that he can, you know, give his side of the story." "Whoa, who do you think you are? What are you, from Galilee like he is?" They start mocking him. You know, he's kind of stepping out there defending Jesus a little bit. It's interesting how it is as a Christian in the world, right? Or not even a Christian yet, but maybe the Lord's drawing. And you're not born again yet, but, well, the Lord's really working on you. And you get out there in the world and conversations come up and you're like, "Man, I'm not getting into this. I don't want to bring up Jesus. You know, they're all going to think I'm a fanatic and I'm a religious nut and everything." But boy, I tell you, when the Lord gets a hold of you, right, he just keeps tugging at you and you hear the conversation and finally you just got to say, "Well, you know what? You guys don't know what you're talking about, you know, with Christianity, because I'm actually a Christian and this is how it is." Well, that's what Nicodemus kind of does. And I mentioned last time, by the time you get to John 19, crucifixion, burial, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus publicly take the body of Christ, prepare it for burial, bury it. If he was a secret disciple before that, he's not a secret disciple anymore. Everybody knows. All the Jews know. The Sanhedrin, they all know. Those guys are disciples of Christ. They're not a part of us anymore, and they probably did get kicked out of the Sanhedrin immediately. Well, Nicodemus was wrong, and he came to that realization of wrongness. And so, at conversion, and so tonight I want to talk here for a while about the realization of wrongness post-conversion, after you're saved, but you're still wrong, because did you know Christians can still be wrong? Is everybody aware of that? Nobody's shocked by that one? It was a Nazarene church. They wouldn't like that. I used to know some Nazarenes that, "Oh, no, I've not sinned in 27 years. I haven't sinned in 27 seconds, and I'm a pastor." So, but more power to you. "You're living in sin for 27 years, you arrogant, prideful." I can't think of a nice word. I'm sorry. See, that's how sinful I am. I can't even keep from sinning in my sermons. But it's righteous indignation, so that counts, right? That's okay. Okay, so realization of wrongness post-conversion, and what I want to look at here is Simon Peter as the example on that. I love Simon Peter. I'm going to shake his hand when I get to heaven. I'm going to say, "You know how many sermons I got out of you? A bunch. You were my example about a million times." And he'll say, "Yeah, you know how much we sat up here and made fun of you down there?" Yeah. Okay, so we can still be wrong, you know, and that's hard to admit, but Christian maturity admits when they're wrong. And with Simon Peter, I've got three examples here I want to look at. The first one is, I could give you a bunch, but this is probably the most prominent one in Peter's life when he denied Christ. That was a mistake, right? That was a sin. I mean, whatever you want to call it, that was not good. And it was preceded by a sin that was linked to it. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Andrew? What's that? Yeah, because he was bragging about how he would never do that. Don't ever brag about what you will never do. Because guess what you will probably do in some way, shape, form, or fashion? "Oh, I'll never deny Christ. No, I'll never deny you. Not in a million years." You shouldn't brag about that on anything. What you should say is, "By God's grace, I'll never do that." Okay? And that's as, because without grace, you're liable to do anything. All right, so Peter had bragged, and not only, I mean, there was sin all over that. There was pride in the fact that he bragged that he wouldn't do it. There was also, he wasn't exactly charitable toward his brethren when he said, "Everyone else may fall away, but I never will." I mean, was that necessary? You know how the people that they just can't seem to say anything without insulting someone? I mean, even if they're just trying to tell a story, they have to insult people. It's just how they're wired. It's kind of how Peter was. Everyone else may fall away. They'll fall away. They probably will. I don't trust any of them, Jesus, and I don't blame you for not trusting them, but I will never fall away. You're talking to Jesus. And the thing is with Peter, you suspect that he loves Jesus. He wants to please Jesus. And he's expecting Jesus to say, "Oh, Peter, I'm so thankful for your love for me, and you're so courageous, and you're so faithful, and I always know that you're my right-hand man. You'll be right there with..." But Jesus is Jesus, and so he knows the truth. And he doesn't even let Peter go on and, you know, live in that dream world for a couple hours. He tells him, "Peter, before the rooster crows, you're going to deny three times that you even know me." "Oh, this will never happen." Never happen. It happens. It did. And, Peter, deeply convicted over it, he went off and wept bitterly, the Bible tells us. It was undoubtedly one of the major moments of his life. But, okay, he made a mistake. He makes another mistake. This one's kind of interesting. And in fact, okay, here's the mistake he made. He denied Christ. Now, what is the end result of that as Christ deals with Peter being wrong, all right? Peter was wrong after conversion. He denied Christ. He said he never would. He bragged about how he never would. He threw his buddies under the bus. All this junk. Peter's got to feel miserable, worthless. What does Jesus do when it's all said and done? He restores him. He forgives him. And he says, "You're still going to work for me. You're not going back to fishing. You're going to take care of my sheep." All right, well, in the process of that, even in the process of Jesus restoring Peter, Peter makes another mistake. And I want to read that. That's in John 21. That's what I was telling you earlier. I'm going to be there for just a moment. John 21, verse 15. All right, this is when Peter is being restored. And notice, see if you can pick up on maybe something that he could have just not said. John 21, beginning in verse 15, "So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?' And he said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Tend my lambs.' He said to him again a second time, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Shepherd my sheep.' He said to him the third time, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me?' Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, 'Do you love me?' And he said to him, 'Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you.' And Jesus said to him, 'Tend my sheep.'" All right, first of all, how many times did he deny that he knew Christ? Three. How many times did Jesus ask him? Three. Okay, I don't think that's an accident. He's restored, all right? He blew it three times, restored three times. Jesus is gracious to him, extremely gracious. And as we keep reading verse 18, "Truly, truly, I say to you," this is Jesus talking to Peter, "'truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself, walk wherever you wished, but when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go.' Now this he said, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, 'Follow me.'" I mean, follow me is an easy thing to say if you're saying, you know, follow me to the end of the street. He just told him how he's going to die. It's clearly a reference to crucifixion, isn't it? You're going to be stretched out. You're going to be taken somewhere you don't want to go. And John records, he was telling us how Peter was going to die. Now follow me. All right? That's where following me is going to lead you. You talk so big about wanting to be like me and follow me and, oh, I'll die with you. Oh, yes, you will. In fact, you'll die in the same manner in which I died, physically speaking. Follow me. You know, it would be hard to imagine the gravity of the moment where Jesus just told you how you're going to die. I don't want to know that, you know? I mean, you think about that sometimes. If you could know how you were going to die, would you want to know? No, I don't want to know, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how I'm told. It's just not information that I want to live with. I just want to assume that I'm going to fall asleep at 120 and wake up in heaven. All right? And I'll just keep assuming that. Actually, I don't care how it happens, as long as it's fast, you know? It's whatever. Just pow. Every now and then someone says, you know, the way you preach, you're going to get yourself killed someday. I said, that's what I'm trying to do. Are you kidding? I know it sounds bad, but there's a sense in which, you know, quick one's better. Well, Peter's told he's going to be crucified. I mean, that's the most ghastly way to die in that culture. And Jesus just did it. I mean, it just happened to him. And Jesus just tells him, this is what's going to happen to you. Now, if you're Peter in that situation, you love Jesus, all right? We've just had the conversation. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Yes, yes, yes. And he even says to Jesus, you know all things. You know I love you, which is to say what? Jesus, if I was faking it, you would know, because you know everything. You know I'm being genuine when I say that I love you. Okay, well, here's how you're going to die. How do you handle that? I mean, put yourself in Peter's place there. How do you handle that? Wow. Oh, Lord, I'm going to need your strength. I'm going to need you every step of the way. If this is what awaits me, I mean, you've already talked in previous times about us being persecuted, and it just seems like, physically speaking, life's going to be really rough for me for the rest of my life, and Jesus, I'm going to need you. Now, that would be perfect, wouldn't it? That's the perfect response. That's a perfect response for us. We don't know the future as well as Peter did, but what I do know is I need Jesus every day. And if I don't have him, you know, I take my eyes off of him, it's a mess. Okay, back to Peter. That's not what he said. Verse 19, now this he said, Jesus said to him, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, follow me. Verse 20, this is when Peter should have said, oh Lord, yes, I'll follow you. Please just give me strength. And look what Peter says, verse 20. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, that would be John, following them, the one who also leaned back on his bosom at the supper, and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? That's John, verse 20. He's telling you that's John. Verse 21, so Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Does that seem like a mistake? Does that seem like something maybe he shouldn't have asked? That's what's, you know, it's kind of funny. Would Peter feel better if John was getting crucified too? Is that what he's getting at? Why are you even asking that? It just seems like a mistake. It seems like he shouldn't have asked it. And I think Jesus makes it very clear he shouldn't have asked it in how Jesus answers him. Because if you notice what Jesus says, 21, so Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? Verse 22, Jesus said to him, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. That's pretty stern. What about him? You know what Jesus told him? It's none of your business. It's none of your business. And so when you see Jesus' response here to Peter, okay, you have the denial. How does Jesus deal with it? He deals with it with restoration. He's gracious. He restores him. He forgives him. When you deal with just this petty nosiness, how does Jesus deal with the petty nosiness? With interrogation, which is to say he asks a question. That's what I'm getting at when I talk about the power of asking questions. What about him? Jesus says in a question, right? What is that to you? What is that to you? A rhetorical question. Peter's not going to answer it if he's smart. What is that to you? What business is that of yours? What becomes of him? What is that to you? Here's what I say to you. Follow me. Okay, that's what I left you with, and that's what I'm leaving you with. Follow me. All right, so that's Peter being questioned by Jesus. And the last one, that, you know, really, in terms of Peter's mistakes post-conversion. This will be the last one, and then I'll get to Paul here for a while. I think, obviously, of Galatians 2, where Peter is a hypocrite, you know, where he's with the Gentiles, and then when the Jews come down from Jerusalem, he separates. And, of course, Paul sees that. Paul confronts that. Galatians 2, verse 14, when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas, that's Peter, in the presence of all, if you being a Jew live like the Gentiles and do not live like the Jews, how is it you compel Gentiles to live like Jews? And so when you look at the three mistakes here that I've outlined, Peter, after he was saved, now this is not unregenerate Peter, this is saved Peter, how was he responded to with the denial, restoration? With the nosiness, interrogation, Jesus said, what is that to you? And with the hypocrisy, confrontation. Paul confronted him in front of everyone. Because, and really, you know, there's a time to publicly talk to somebody like that, and not very often. And there's a time to privately, which is the vast majority of times the way to do it. This is a special circumstance because you have Peter, who is probably the most prominent Christian on the planet. I mean, him and Paul may be, at this time, is probably still Peter. And what he's doing is not just being rude to the Gentiles. He is distorting the gospel because they've just gone through all of this stuff about the gospel and the law and Judaism and circumcision and all this stuff. And finally, you know, they even have councils over this. They get it all lined out, and here's Peter, like, dragging them back again into this dividing the Jews and the Gentiles. And what are the Gentiles thinking? Oh, did we have it wrong? What are the Jews thinking? Remember what Paul said? Even Barnabas was led astray by the hypocrisy. So Peter's action, it's a public action that threatens to destroy this church in terms of their understanding of the gospel. This is a major problem. And it's one of those things that no matter what line of work you're in, you encounter things at times that you know it's going to be a major problem if you don't deal with it now, right? Like, I don't want to have to deal with this today, but if I don't, 2 weeks down the road, it's going to be a mess. And so I'm going to deal with it today. And that's what Paul does right there. He doesn't pull Peter aside. He doesn't say, hey, we need to have a talk. He did, okay, just let him shoot his mouth off and I'll spend the next 6 months correcting this in my teaching. He says, Peter, right here in front of all these people, I got something to say to you. And in so doing, what does he do? He restores the gospel that fast. Peter, you're wrong. And what does Peter do? I mean, I think Peter probably knew immediately that he was wrong. He knew while he was doing it, he was wrong. All right. In all three cases, by the way, Peter responds the correct way. He follows Christ, right? I mean, every time he follows Christ, he gets restored. He denies Christ, he's restored. What does he do? Follow me, Jesus says. And Peter does. He sticks his nose into John's business. Jesus rebukes him. What business is that of yours? You follow me. And he does. Paul has to confront him over this little incident. And what happens? Going forward from that point on, as you see Peter in the Gospels, what does he do? He follows Christ. And so, you know, Peter, he's one of those guys that can be your best friend or your worst enemy on the same day, you know? Because who knows what he's going to say. And then, but deep down in his heart, he really is faithful, isn't he? He loves the Lord. He gets himself in trouble sometimes, but he loves the Lord. All right, so let's move here to Paul. Everybody doing good? We've got a few minutes here, so I'm just going to keep trucking. I'm taking up the singing time by continuing on with the preaching tonight. So I think, man, he's going longer than usual. Well, you know, I figure I got you till 7 o'clock. So. All right, so questions is what I'm going to talk about now, and the power of questions and using questions and how that can be done. You saw one little example there with Jesus in his rebuke of Peter. What is that to you? That's a question. He wasn't expecting an answer. We all ask questions where we don't expect answers, right? Say to a kid, for example, what do you think you're doing? Don't want an answer, right? I know what you're doing, and that's why I ask the question rhetorically and in that tone of voice. We all do that. All right, so let's look at some questions here regarding the Apostle Paul and some questions that sometimes he asked and sometimes were asked of him. And the first section I want to look at here is at his conversion. It's interesting. I began tonight by reading Acts 22, so I'm back in Acts 22 again now. There's, I think, three different accounts of Paul's conversion in the book of Acts. Once, when it actually happens, and then two other times when he recounts it. Acts 22 is one of the times he's recounting it. And here's the question that he's asked in verse 7. He's recounting it. I fell to the ground. I heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Okay? He's being asked a question, right? Jesus is asking him a question. Why are you, and there's no question who he's talking to, right? Saul, Saul. Somebody says to me, Shane, Shane, why are you persecuting me? You talking to Sam? This is Shane, Shane, right? There's no, imagine that. You're blinded. Whoever this is obviously a terrifying person. And he's calling you by name twice and says, why are you persecuting me? The toughest of men would melt in such a situation. He's blind, right? Now, Paul may be tough, but no matter how tough you are, if you're blind and the guy right there is the one that blinded you, that's a scary situation. Why, he says, why are you persecuting me? Now, it's a rhetorical question in a sense, but what if Jesus had pressed? He doesn't. Jesus doesn't press. Why are you persecuting me? And Paul says what? Who art thou, Lord? He answers a question with a question. But what if Jesus had paused there? Why are you persecuting me? Who art thou, Lord? We'll get to that in a minute. Why are you persecuting me? What would he have said? Well, or if Jesus had said, you know, who art thou, Lord? I'm Jesus. Now, back to my question. Why are you persecuting me? What would Paul have answered? What would have been his answer? Why was he attacking Christianity so bad? Any thoughts as I take a drink? What's his problem with Christianity? He does. He thinks it's a perverted version of Judaism. It's wrong. They're a bunch of heretics. He's violently opposed to it. I mean, violently to the point of killing, you know, like with Stephen. And he mentions, you know, other murderous threats of his. Any other thoughts?
Oh, but I got a question.
Uh-oh. Well, Van, if somebody blinds you and knocks you on your can, it's wise to call them Lord. Well, here's the thing. Lord, does he mean it in the sense of divinity or does he mean it in the sense of sir? Because it can just be a title of respect. Whoever it is, see, he doesn't know who it is apparently, but he respects him. Or at least he fears him, you know. Who art thou, Lord? It could be that he suspects maybe it's Jesus. Now, if that were the case, what I would argue, and I have had this thought before, that when Paul is breathing those murderous threats against Christianity, something's nagging in the back of his mind saying, you know what, I think this is true. And that's why he's so violently opposed to it. Because he's devoted his life to something that is not true. If Christianity turns out to be right and Paul turns out to be wrong, I mean, he's outdone all of his classmates. He's outdone everybody in terms of zeal for the law. all these things, and now you've got someone named Jesus coming along saying that he's fulfilled the law, he's the Christ, he's the Son of God, he's died on the cross for the sins of his people. Everything Saul of Tarsus believes is crumbling down toward his feet. And it's more than just a change in beliefs. This is his life. He's a rabbi. And so I suspect at times, you know, Jesus said, no one can come to me unless my Father draws, or if the Spirit draws. You know, it's phrased various ways. The Lord draws the elect. He draws them. And sometimes, you know, that seems like an instantaneous thing. Boy, I never heard the gospel in my life. I heard the gospel, and boom, I was saved. But a lot of times that drawing takes place over the course of time, doesn't it? You start feeling convicted about things. Maybe you start attending church, and maybe it's years of attending church, and maybe it's years of wrestling with conviction. You know, different people, God works with them in different ways. What if Saul of Tarsus is already being drawn by the Holy Spirit? In other words, what if there's conviction going on? When he's giving hearty approval to Stephen being stoned, what if something in the back of his mind saying, oh, this is a faithful man? I don't think Stephen's wrong, but he has to be wrong because he stands against everything I stand for. Now, if that's the case, then a pretty good argument could be made for when Paul is on his way to hopefully kill more Christians in his mind, and something, it seems, supernatural happens. I mean, he's blinded. You know, it's bright light and a voice. These all are hallmarks of visits from God, right? You think of Moses in the Old Testament. I mean, you think of, you know, the burning bush and things of that nature. This is Paul encountering something. I mean, what are you going to think if it's a bright light and a voice and you're blinded and you're knocked down and you're living in that type of religious atmosphere? Your first thought might be, is this a visit from God? In which case, if that's the case, that would explain him using the word Lord and perhaps meaning it in a divine way. And like I said, you could just use the word Lord in a respectful way. As a, who is this? But it seems all these manifestations are not just a normal person, you know, fighting him or something. The bright light, you know, the blindness and things of that nature. Does that make sense? Oh, yeah, yeah. Right. Well, I guess he escalated Jesus to lordship real fast, so which, you know, might have happened. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, well, imagine... Yeah, because it didn't come back quick. Now, I suspect that for a while there, Paul probably thought he's never going to see again. You know, boy, I've really been humbled now. You know, so I suspect that's what he meant by all that. I mean, who knows? But you know, Jesus asks a question, and Paul answers with a question. Why are you persecuting me? Well, he doesn't give him an answer, but I think, you know, some of the things we've mentioned here give us some of the answers. He opposed Christianity. He saw it as a heretical religion, an offshoot of Judaism, but a bad one. He didn't think Jesus was the Messiah, obviously. He didn't think he was the Christ. How about this one? He didn't think the resurrection really happens. Because if the resurrection happened, then what is he fighting against exactly? Now, the interesting thing about that, to me, is who was the rabbi that warned them to leave the Christians alone? Gamaliel. Now, does Paul have a link to him? Indeed, that's Paul's rabbi. I mean, that's Paul's primary teacher. So in Acts 5, they were ready to kill all of the apostles, Peter and the whole lot of them. And as they were considering this in Acts 5, Gamaliel puts them out. He says, you know, put the apostles out, and he has a word with the Sanhedrin. And he says, he gives them a couple of examples. There was a guy named Judas, not the same Judas, not Judas Iscariot. You know, he had a little, you know, rising, and it, you know, became nothing. There was a guy named Thaddeus that had people follow after him, fizzled out. That's what will happen here too, okay? If Jesus is just another Judas or Thaddeus, these wannabe Messiah figures, if Jesus is just another one of those, trust me, Rome can handle it. They can take care of it. You stay out of it. Now, if he had just said that and left it at that, you would have thought, no, he's just a, you know, loyal Sanhedrinist. Ah, Jesus is, he's phony and Rome will squelch this whole following. But Gamaliel continues on. And he says, you know, if he's like one of those, it'll fizzle out. But if he's not, if he really is who he claims to be, then you will find yourself fighting against God. That's an incredible warning that he gives. That's good counsel he gives them, in fact. The Sanhedrin, do not kill these guys because you might be messing with God. Why would Gamaliel say that? You know what Gamaliel's doing right here? I mean, he's totally in front of the Sanhedrin saying, I think there's a chance Jesus is exactly who he said he was. I think these Christians might be of God. He's not coming flat out and saying, I absolutely believe that, but he said, they might be of God, and if you mess with them, you're messing with God. Now, one of those people he could have been talking to was Paul. I mean, he's talking to the, where is Paul during all this? Jerusalem. I mean, he's there around that time. He's persecuting Christians around that time. If Paul's not there, he certainly talked to Gamaliel at other times. He's his mentor. Hey, Gamaliel, what do you think of these Christians? I think you should leave them alone. That's what I think. And what's Paul saying? No way. I'm going to get them all. Listen to your teacher there, boy. And so it's interesting. If he sees Christianity as such a horrendous threat against Judaism, he sure didn't take the advice of his rabbi who said, leave them alone. Because if they're of God, you won't be able to destroy them. Paul, in his vigor and in his violence and in his young, tough, know-it-all-ness, Gamaliel, forget that. I'm going to go chase them to Damascus. All right, but don't say I didn't warn you, right? And now, boom, he's blinded. Whom art thou, Lord? I'm Jesus, whom you're persecuting. Now what's Paul thinking? Oh, no, Gamaliel was right. I've been fighting against God. It's exactly what Gamaliel said. And so there goes that in terms of Saul's answer. Saul answers, who art thou, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you're, this is verse 8. He said, I am Jesus the Nazarene whom you're persecuting, and those who were with me saw the light to be sure, but they did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said, get up, go into Damascus, and there you'll be told all has been appointed for you to do. And so he asked another question. Who art thou, Lord? What am I to do, Lord? Guess what? He sounds like a convert now, doesn't he? He sounds like a disciple. He's looking to Jesus for direction instead of looking for Jesus' followers to kill. All right, one more here. At his arrest and flogging, and then we'll wrap it up. This is a little further down in Acts 22. Paul using a question here in a masterful way. Notice how he does it. Acts 22, verse 23. And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, the commander ordered him, Paul, to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. Verse 25, but when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, here's a question, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman? That's probably how he said it. A Roman and uncondemned. I want everybody around to hear that as they've got me strapped here. Is it lawful for you to scourge a Roman who's uncondemned? What? thought you were a Jew. I am. I'm also a Roman. That's a masterful use of the question, isn't it? Paul didn't say, hey, you can't do that to me. Hey, I just want to brush up on Roman law here, Mr. Centurion. Is it lawful for you to flog a Roman citizen? That's my question. Yeah. You just fill me in there. You know more about Roman law than I do. Have they changed the rule about Roman citizens being flogged? Okay, we get the point, right? Yep. Verse 26, when the centurion heard this, he went to the commander, and he used a question. Notice that. Saying, what are you about to do? For this man is a Roman. Is it lawful for you to flog a Roman? You're a Roman? Ooh, he goes to his commander. What are you doing? He's a Roman. That lets you know, by the way, the importance of being a Roman. Paul had a very unique heritage because he was a Jew of Jews, right? But being from Tarsus, he was a Roman Jew. And he had certain status that, you know, other Jews wouldn't have had. And so he uses it, too. When he needs to, he uses it. Gets him out of a flogging, and I don't blame him for that. All right, we're going to stop there.